This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
With some fresh optimism, reviving the Iran nuclear deal appears close. But as I say, close only counts in horseshoes.
Nothing is agreed until everything is agreed.
Also today, North Korea claimed they successfully launched a monster missile. But after digging in, the facts just didn't add up.
It's almost like you went and looked at Kim Jong-un and you asked him like, hey, did you eat those brownies? And he says, no, I don't know who did it, but he's got chocolate smeared all over his face.
Plus, after thousands of years, bison are being reintroduced to the UK. Ecologists hope rewilding will improve biodiversity in Britain. And in Iraq, rethinking the mustache.
A lot of young men are less keen to emulate the facial hair of their fathers and grandfathers. Outlandish, stiffly gelled hairdos are becoming quite popular.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us today. In Ukraine, fears of a nuclear catastrophe continue to grow. Fighting is ongoing at Europe's largest nuclear power plant. Both Russian and Ukrainian officials have been accusing the others over who is responsible for renewed shelling there. Russian forces are occupying Ukraine's Zaporizhia plant. Ukrainian workers are operating it, although some have left. Loveday Mars with The Washington Post recently spoke with a number of workers from the plant. We reached her today in eastern Ukraine.
We dropped down a little bit south of Zaporizhia to where people cross out of Russian-controlled territory and into Ukrainian-controlled territory. And there are columns of cars coming out actually at the moment because the area has become a little bit less stable in recent weeks. And in those cars are workers from the plant themselves who are also leaving.
And you spoke with several Ukrainian workers who had been employed at the plant. What kind of jobs were they doing and what was the picture they drew for you of their concerns?
We spoke to some engineers and a couple of operational workers who worked servicing equipment in the plant. I mean, the plant's been under Russian control since early March, and they described, you know, working under extreme stress. And over the past month is when we've started to have the outgoing shelling from the plant. So these workers described a situation where they were already in under high stress, working in an environment where several workers had disappeared. People were talking about their colleagues disappearing. People are scared to talk, you know, even with their friends. They're worried about people reporting. And working in a really high stress environment, they're having their phones taken off them, being searched. And then over the past month, that's really escalated as the Russians have used the plant as a base for their outgoing fire across the river to Nikopol on the other side. And then obviously what we've also had in recent weeks is incoming fire to the plant, which has sparked a huge amount of concern, obviously, globally.
So some senior workers still there, but without kind of like the human labor at the Zaporizhia plant, what concerns are there that puts its future in even greater jeopardy?
It's unclear what percentage of the workforce, you know, has left. But, you know, even if they're not critical staff, if it's staff that's servicing equipment, and it just means, you know, generally it's already a high stress environment and workers are overstretched. And there are definitely concerns about what that means for the functioning of a nuclear plant, especially when you have explosions, incoming shells.
What have experts in Ukraine told you about the scenarios that concern them the most about how all this could play out?
Zaporizhia is built with a lot more safeguards than something like Chernobyl. There's reinforced concrete and steel encasements for the reactors that are there. They're built to withstand extreme sort of attacks and plane crashes. But obviously, it's a huge concern when you have live fire within a nuclear power station.
Have you spoken with Ukrainian officials in Kyiv about what precautions they might be taking in the event of a nuclear incident?
My colleagues who are in Kyiv have been talking to officials there. obviously what Ukraine is calling for is a complete deoccupation of the plant and for Russian troops to leave.
Well, some workers from the plant have fled, as you said. What about other residents in the area? How are they preparing themselves for the what-if scenarios?
Yeah, a lot of people we spoke to who are coming out, obviously some people are just trying to get as far away as they can. Some people have been given anti-radiation pills by their local councils. Across the river, we went to Nikopol, which is being shelled quite heavily from the plant. From there, you can see the nuclear power plant across the water. Some people are quite fatalistic about it and say, you know, if something happens, there's nothing we can do. And why should we leave our homes? But there's definitely, you know, a deep fear for people who've stayed. And it's hard to know what Russia's intention is. But by putting that plant right on the front lines of this conflict, perhaps that is Russia's intention to spread fear in these areas and across the breadth of Europe.
Loveday Morris is a reporter for The Washington Post. She's been speaking to us from eastern Ukraine about the mounting risks at the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. In Kenya, William Ruto was announced yesterday the winner of that country's presidential election. That does not mean the decision is final. Ruto's main opponent is challenging the results, along with some people who served on the election commission. From Nairobi, the world's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi has the latest.
Most Kenyans were hoping that the election period would come to an end after the results were announced yesterday. That's because during elections, daily life in the country comes to a standstill. Many schools and shops remain closed as people warily wait to see what the reactions will be. Today, presidential candidate Raila Odinga made his feelings clear.
We totally and without reservations reject the presidential results announced yesterday by Mr. Chebukati.
Odinga called the results null and void and cited how four of Kenya's top electoral commissioners are denouncing the results too. One of them is Juliana Cherera. This is what she said about the results announced by the head of Kenya's electoral commission, Wafula Chebukati, yesterday.
Belonged to himself and do not represent the declaration and announcement by Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission.
She and the other dissenting commissioners alleged they had not been given the chance to discuss election discrepancies or agree on the final results. They also suggested the numbers didn't add up. This was a surprising turn because election observers have actually said this has been one of the most transparent elections in Kenya's recent history. Joyce Majiwa is with the Independent Elections Observation Group in Kenya.
So this was open. There was more transparency. Efficiency was greater.
She pointed out how the Electoral Commission uploaded the result forms from all of the polling stations onto their public website so anyone could tally independently. Her organization also found that Ruto won this election, and so did Daniel Kalia, a 29-year-old investment analyst who teamed up with a group of volunteers to comb through polling data.
There was an opportunity to do your own independent tallying and verification and see whether there will be any differences in what is uploaded versus what is being announced.
Their findings also showed that Ruto was the winner by a slim margin. Outside, where Raila Odinga announced he was rejecting the results, I spoke with one of his supporters, Francis Omondi, a university student. He said that the fact that four election commissioners have rejected the results makes him suspicious.
There might be something behind it. And we just want to know, we as Kenyans, we do pay these people to work for us. The IEBC should be independent. We want to know what went wrong.
It's unusually quiet in Nairobi's normally bustling central business district. Taxi driver Titus Mutia is hoping a customer will pass by. Mutia tells me this election is over and Raila Odinga has lost. He said it's time for life to go back to normal. Odinga has said he will pursue all legal channels to protest this election. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
An agreement to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal appears closer than ever. That's according to Iran. Iran's negotiating team has expressed some remaining concerns, but said the outstanding issues would not be difficult to resolve. We've been here before, though, many times. Joining me now is Nesan Rafati. He's a senior analyst for Iran at Crisis Group, an NGO focused on conflict resolution. So, as I said, Nesan, we've been down this closer than ever road ever since Biden arrived at the White House. What is it about this newest proposal, this moment, that makes it compelling to Iran such that there seems to be some optimism today?
The pendulum has kept swinging from being close to the point of breakthrough a few months ago to seeming at the point of breakdown only a few weeks ago. And essentially what's changed over the past several weeks is that the European Union has made another throw of the diplomatic dice to try to bring this deal closer towards finalization. They proposed a text towards the end of July and brought all of the parties back to Vienna, because it was the first time that all of the parties to the negotiations, so that's the US, Iran, the three European countries, Russia and China. As of yesterday, the Iranians have provided a written response. There are several issues that are still outstanding. None of them are new, but none of them have been fully resolved. So that's essentially where we stand right now.
Do you credit the EU players for this latest round of energy around reviving the deal? I mean, how significant are they?
I think one of the idiosyncrasies in this entire process has been that, first of all, you're negotiating over a deal that's already been negotiated once. So we're essentially relitigating a path to reentering an existing deal. So that's a bit odd. And the second thing is that throughout this process, the Iranians have not engaged directly with the US. So the two central protagonists in this story have been discussing things indirectly. Now, it's either through the EU, it's either through regional mediators like the Qataris, and it's fallen to the EU, which in the JCPOA is the facilitator.
So thanks to this return to Vienna, what seem to be the new points of agreement? What is the common ground?
It's more the areas of disagreement that are right now at the core of it. And these relate to the extent of sanctions that the U.S. would put on the table. And from the Iranian point of view, this has been a quite adamant demand, is this notion of guarantees. They look at the experience in 2018 when the Trump administration withdrew from the agreement unilaterally, despite saying that Iran was actually complying with the provisions of the agreement, and are saying that, well, we don't know how this won't happen again in 2025 if there's a change in administrations.
Well, former U.S. Secretary of Energy Ernest Moniz, who was instrumental in negotiating the original deal under Obama, has said that because of this interlude, where there has been no deal, there's been no strong nuclear inspection protocols in place. So really, if Iran signs the deal, there's no way to know they're pursuing a nuclear weapon covertly. What are your thoughts on that?
Look, I think that over the past couple of months, the Iranians have put in place some pretty significant limits on the International Atomic Energy Agency's ability to have real-time access into those sites. If there is an agreement, the IAEA will have to go to those Iranian sites and essentially try to reconstruct what's happened over the past couple of months at those facilities, try to be able to account for the nuclear material, the centrifuges, the stockpiles that Iran has been working on over this period, and to ensure that whatever gaps in the knowledge, the continuity of knowledge, as the IAEA calls it, is restored to the extent possible.
So at some point in the next couple of weeks, if you had to put odds on a deal going through, better than 50-50?
I've stopped giving odds a long time ago, but I think the negotiators know this better than anyone, because on the front page of the draft that they've been working on, and the French negotiator tweeted this a few months ago, it says on the front page, nothing is agreed until everything is agreed.
Nesan Rafati is a senior analyst for Iran at Crisis Group, an NGO focused on resolving conflict. Nesan, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Marco.
You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/theworld. That's odoo.com/theworld.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We often associate bison with the Wild West, but many years ago in what is now Great Britain, wild bison roamed those ranges. Like many native animals, though, they eventually disappeared. Now, thousands of years later, wild bison have been brought back to Britain. The hope is that these large mammals will help manage local woodlands, tackling a lack of biodiversity and climate change along the way. Richard Kemeny has a story from southeast England, where he starts by introducing us to a male bison who's got a critical role to play.
Meet Orsk. He's a 2,000-pound European bison, munching away on a tasty bunch of birch leaves. Orsk lives in an enclosure in West Blean and Thorndon Woods, an 800-hectare ancient forest by Canterbury in southeast England. After his snack, it's time for a dust bath.
So he's scent marking the ground, he's urinating on the sand, and then kicking it around with his feet, and now he's just about to roll all around in it and make himself smell beautiful for the lady bison that he can smell out in the woods.
Paul Whitfield is the Director General of the Wildwood Trust. The ladies he's referring to are the first wild bison to roam the UK for over 6,000 years. One older matriarch from Scotland and two younger females from Ireland are stomping around in the woods nearby. After a few importation delays thanks to Brexit, they were released last month to much fanfare. Soon they'll be joined by a bull from Germany, and if all goes to plan, they'll breed new genetic lions. Their mission is simple, to tramble through a former commercial timber plantation, replacing a monoculture with a complex mix of woodland, essentially making it wild again. They will break down trees, letting in light and creating space for other animals to thrive. They will tear off bark with their thick fur, leaving behind standing dead trees loved by insects and birds like the lesser-spotted woodpecker. And with their dust baths, urine and dung, Whitfield says, they will fertilize and enrich the soil, creating new habitats for a whole host of organisms.
It will create an environment that carries more biodiversity, captures more carbon, but also creates a landscape that's far more resilient to the changes we've already created through climate change. So in the middle of a hot, dry summer, you will have a woodland that's far more capable of tolerating drought and disease. And in a wetter, warmer winter, again, it will be able to deal with that better and avoid disease.
There are GPS trackers on the bison, and an extensive monitoring system will take stock of their impacts over time.
So there's drones mapping vegetation, there's individual people going in and taking samples, so we're doing literally everything from insects to reptiles to bats to birds to moths to vegetation.
The bison release comes at a time when the UK is facing heat waves and now drought. And ecologically speaking, it's not doing so well, according to Richard Bunting, spokesman for Rewilding Britain, an NGO.
Britain is in a very poor state in terms of its biodiversity. We've been ranked one of the worst countries in the world for the state of our biodiversity. Rewilding gives us an opportunity to start repairing that damage.
He says rewilding, a conservation strategy that works to restore wilderness, isn't the silver bullet for tackling current crises, but it is an effective strategy with a lot of potential.
What it does offer is nature-based solutions to these serious problems. And at the moment, we're really only scratching the surface of those solutions. We're playing around at the edges. Something like 1% of Britain is currently rewilding. You know, 1% is pretty pathetic. We could be doing a lot better.
At the moment, it's three bison in a small, you know, in a small patch of woods just outside Canterbury.
That's Bob Smith, director of the Durrell Institute of Conservation and Ecology at the University of Kent.
Long term, woodlands with large herbivores in across the UK would be one of the best ways that we could capture carbon.
For the most part, public opinion in Britain is broadly supportive of rewilding. But here in the countryside, some locals are concerned about damage to the woodlands and how the fences that keep the bison in will keep people and their dogs out. The challenge is convincing local landowners about the benefits. Smith thinks ecotourism could help here.
We've now got beavers that, you know, just about to reintroduce choughs around Dover, and we've got lots of nature reserves. It's a beautiful place to visit. And so the fact that we could be the sort of ecotourism wilding hub for southeast England, you know, I don't think is too impossible. And so, yeah, it could really be an important part of our economy.
Paul Whitfield says that when it comes to tackling biodiversity loss and climate change, the Bison Project is just one part of the puzzle, an optimistic one.
I actually think that is really powerful, and possibly more powerful than what they're actually going to do in the woodlands here, because it would be inspire people to be positive and do stuff rather than just giving up and being depressed about how awful it all is.
And these days, everyone could use a little positivity. For The World, I'm Richard Kemeny.
This next story takes us back to March 1973, when the Academy Awards were being handed out in Hollywood.
The winner is Marlon Brando in The Godfather.
Some 1,300 miles northeast of Los Angeles, another drama had been playing out on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, in a town called Wounded Knee, where U.S. troops slaughtered hundreds of Native people in 1890. In 1973, 200 Oglala Lakota and members of the American Indian Movement occupied the site.
We have declared Wounded Knee an independent country and the corporate state for the Oglala Nation to present our Declaration of Independence.
Oglala Sioux activist Russell Means was addressing the crowd.
And we are asking that the United States government secede from the Oglala Nation and get the hell out of here.
Meantime, back at the Oscars in Los Angeles, the cameras focused on a young Apache woman, a friend of Marlon Brando.
Accepting the award for Marlon Brando and The Godfather, Miss Shasheen Littlefeather.
Littlefeather walked to the podium wearing braids, buckskin, and moccasins.
Hello, my name is Shasheen Littlefeather. I'm Apache, and I'm president of the National Native American Affirmative Image Committee. I'm representing Marlon Brando this evening, and he has asked me to tell you in a very long speech, which I cannot share with you presently because of time.
The ceremony producer had given her 60 seconds to talk. Marlon Brando's speech was 8 pages long. Littlefeather held it in her hand, stared down Hollywood's elite, and said Brando regrets he cannot accept this award.
And the reasons for this being are the treatment of American Indians today by the film industry, excuse me.
Littlefeather's speech was short, but the response was huge. Actor John Wayne went into a rage and had to be restrained. Other actors made jokes about her speech. Shasheen Littlefeather spoke recently about that moment in a podcast from the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences.
I spoke from my heart because the heart and the heartbeat is the voice of all Indigenous people everywhere. And that is exactly what happened in 60 seconds or less.
Yesterday, the Academy formally apologized to her for the mistreatment she experienced during her speech and in the years that followed. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Sri Lanka used to be a country on the rise. Now families of privilege are struggling as grocery prices go through the roof, no gas for cooking and no fuel for the car.
Current situation is horrible. Even we are feeling it. What about the others who can't even afford what we can afford?
A nation trying to make ends meet. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. North Korea has put its neighbors on edge with increasingly frequent ballistic missile tests, but the specter of a long-range ballistic missile, one that can carry multiple nuclear warheads and reach the continental U.S., that's what people in the non-proliferation community call the monster missile. In March, North Korea said they'd successfully tested one. They put out a film featuring leader Kim Jong-un to prove the achievement. That video turns out proved to be something else. Dina Temple-Raston, host of the podcast Click Here, has this exclusive story about the digital sleuthing that upended North Korea's claim.
So back on March 24th, the North Koreans announced that they'd successfully launched the Hwasong-17. It's a monster missile that could evade American missile defense systems by launching multiple nuclear warheads on the continental U.S. And they were so giddy about it, they released this video. This is the actual music from it.
They had Kim Jong-un looking dramatically at his watch, wearing crazy sunglasses. You know, it was this really overproduced video to say that the missile had worked.
Jeffrey Lewis is the director of the East Asia Nonproliferation Project at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies. And he and his team in Monterey began studying that North Korean video back in March. It's unintentionally hilarious. Kim Jong-un is wearing a Top Gun-like leather jacket, and he's walking in slow motion. And he's flanked on either side by two generals. An enormous mobile launch vehicle is slowly trailing along behind them. The video shows the missile powering up, and then about 4 minutes in, liftoff. There's smoke, the missile rises into the air, the music swells, and then the camera cuts to Kim and a bunch of generals punching the air and applauding. The whole production suggests that the great leader had created a missile that will allow him to threaten, really threaten, the U.S. with nuclear war. And Lewis views these propaganda films as incredibly instructive, because
when you catch someone in a lie, then you've learned something really interesting about what they care about. You know what they want you to think, and you know what they want you to not know.
Like, for example, Korean leader Kim Jong-un's preoccupation with a particular part of his anatomy.
Well, my favorite thing that North Korea loves to lie about, which they've stopped doing, so I'm a little disappointed, but they always used to adjust the size of Kim Jong-un's ears. Apparently the man thinks his ears are too big, or at least he did. They've given up on doing that, but we would just see image after image after image when they had made his ears a little bit smaller. And I don't know why you would do that, but they did.
So he clearly cares about his ears.
He clearly cares about his ears, yes.
It seems Kim wants the world to think he has delicate little ears.
His ears look totally normal to me. I don't see what the problem is, but, you know, maybe you should see a therapist about that.
Kim's latest video does tell us one thing about the great leader. He's still incredibly focused on missiles and their size, though those productions only reveal so much. So to see what's really going on, Lewis and his team zoom out and turn to satellites to help fill in the blanks.
Tiny, inexpensive Earth imaging powerhouses delivering data on demand.
That's a promotional video from Planet Labs, one of the hundreds of satellite companies now offering clients snapshots and panoramas of the Earth.
Our constellation of nearly 200 Earth observation satellites currently orbiting Earth is the largest ever.
Right behind Planet in terms of sheer coverage is the Chinese Ministry of Defense. Today's satellite reconnaissance can offer everything from a glimpse into the black boxes of reclusive regimes to the strength of an enemy force. Satellites were once the purview of governments and spy agencies. Now, business people, environmentalists, and researchers like Jeffrey Lewis can look at imagery of the past to inform the future.
One of the things that's changed about satellite imagery over the past decade or two is now there is so much of it. And with so much of it, you actually kind of get some choices.
You can choose from high-resolution images to make out cars and even individuals, or moderate resolution, so a building shows up, but a car would look like a smudge. But these choices have trade-offs. High-resolution images only give you a picture of a very small area.
It is like looking at the Earth through a drinking straw.
So you need to know exactly what you're looking for and exactly where to look. Moderate resolution is a little more forgiving. For example, a satellite company like Planet,
they try to take a picture of the whole Earth every day at about 3 meters in resolution. And so that gives you a ton of coverage.
It becomes like a kind of time-lapse photography.
So what you try to do is watch all the moderate resolution stuff that you're getting all the time so that you know to say, oh, hey, look, something's interesting happening here.
And then you ask the satellite company to take a high-resolution picture there. That's what happened a couple of years ago when pictures came out of Kim Jong-un touring this factory where it was believed North Korea was making crucial parts for short-range ballistic missiles. One of the images had Kim looking at this map that suggested the plant was about to undergo a huge expansion. So Lewis and the Middlebury team now had a place to look. A huge expansion of the plant, if it were true, would be an important thing for the world to know. It would mean that North Korea was stepping up its short and medium range ballistic missile programs. But what if it was a head fake, like Kim's ears? So Lewis and the team started to dig.
When we found the place he visited, they had not started the expansion yet. So it was just this tiny, tiny, tiny little facility.
They had a high-resolution satellite with that soda straw view take some pictures over the course of several months of North Korea's knocking down buildings at the plant and building new ones. And then Lewis and his team told the world.
This expansion is happening. And we really got that all from just Kim standing in front of a map.
North Korea has an extremely large and well-developed missile program.
They used to name the missiles after local places. Pretty soon they ran out of towns and just started numbering them. And we're up into the 30s now. And North Korea has done 6 nuclear tests. And so, at least for someone like me, there is no doubt that North Korea can put a nuclear warhead on a missile and send it all the way to the United States.
But the U.S. can deal with that. It gets more complicated if it's more than one warhead on a missile, which is exactly what North Korea is working on.
And what they really want to do is put multiple warheads in the missile so that they can overwhelm our missile defenses.
And the Hwasong-17 Monster missile was designed to do that. Except,
this guy Colin Zwerko was the first person who said, I don't think this is right.
Zwerko is a senior correspondent for NK News based in Seoul.
And that's music to our ears. Because that is like waving a red flag at a bull. And my whole team was like, well, let's check that out.
There are tools online that you can use to measure the angle of the sun at a particular time of day and determine which direction the shadow should fall.
That's Michael Dusman, one of Lewis's colleagues at the Middlebury Institute. And he kind of specializes in measuring shadows, so he looked at another North Korean missile launch just days before, on March 16th.
We could compare the direction the shadow would fall at the 2 different launch times and determine how that compared with what was seen in the video.
They realized, and this is the first time they're saying this publicly, that the big video they released in March was made using footage from 2 different launches.
I do remember being in the office and Jeffrey slamming his hand on the desk and thinking this was like a really big deal.
Is that true? Does he slam his hand on the desk a lot?
Well, occasionally.
In a good excitement, right?
Right. Yeah.
Lewis pulled up an image from the North Korean video to give me an idea how they pieced it together. It's a wide-angle shot from above. A few scattered buildings, some trees, a road, a long, dark blob, which looks like that launch truck in the propaganda film.
The first image, the truck is sitting on the road at kind of a funny angle. And if you look really closely, you can see this white spot, and that's the missile standing up on end.
It almost looks like a microphone lying on its side with a little sort of white dot at the end.
Yes, that's you should be in radio. And what's notable about this is there's enough detail in this drone image that you can tell exactly where on the road this truck is. And you can see that it's at this kind of slightly funny angle.
Then he shows me the second image from Planet Labs. It's a satellite picture from March 16th, almost 10 days before the Hwasong-17 launch was supposed to have happened.
And it's a very high-resolution image. And it's of exactly the same spot. You can see all the same buildings. You can see the same fields. The road looks the same. Even the damage to the road is identical. And you can really see that detail. And the truck is gone, but there's a black kind of smear. And that smear is the burn scar.
The kind of burn mark you get from a fiery missile launch.
It's a kind of half a rectangle because the burn mark traces the outline of the truck. It's almost like you went and looked at Kim Jong-un and you asked him like, hey, did you eat those brownies? And he says, no, I don't know who did it. But he's got chocolate smeared all over his face. I mean, it's just such a perfect giveaway.
So here's the thing. When Lewis and his team go back to the satellite images from March 24th, the day the North Koreans say they successfully launched the monster missile, those burn marks aren't there.
And I don't see any evidence that it was launched.
No evidence of a launch either that day or in that place. So how do you launch a monster missile without leaving a trace? Well, that started them thinking.
We had already looked at the position of the sun in the video.
That didn't add up either. The launch on the 24th was supposed to be in the afternoon, but the position of the sun in the video suggested that it was filmed in the morning.
It's really this kind of really chaotic, iterative process where what you're trying to do is pull in all this data and compare it, organize it, try to make it make some sense, realize what you're missing, and then go get that data. And you just kind of do it over and over and over again.
Lewis says that while he may be pounding his fist on the desk at various times in the process, there's rarely an aha moment.
What more likely happens is you start to realize what the answer is. You know, there's almost a kind of gravity that the truth has, where it's clear that one answer is simpler than the others, one answer explains all the evidence pretty well.
So the results of the team's investigation pointed to this.
They tested two missiles in March.
One that worked and one that didn't.
The simplest answer is that they launched the big one on the 16th. They filmed it. Kim Jong-un was there, but it blew up. So they couldn't announce it. So they came back a few days later. They launched a different missile that they were pretty sure would work.
Then they release a big splashy video
in order to imply it had worked.
Lewis said he doesn't know where exactly they launched the second smaller missile from, but it obviously wasn't from the same spot with the burn marks that the satellite images captured.
The secret sauce in looking at imagery are the signatures. You know, it's one thing to say, okay, great, here's a picture or a video of a missile launcher, but it's all the little things that go with it, like burn marks and the trailers in the background and the vehicles that are in the background that help over time to develop a real sense about what's going on.
That's John Lauder. He used to serve as director of the CIA's Non-Proliferation Center.
And I'm a believer in those capabilities and what folks like Jeffrey Lewis are doing. The downside is, of course, well, it starts to reveal a bit about how one goes about looking like imagery and helps maybe the North Koreans being a little smarter next time putting together videos that might give something away.
Lauder says next time around, Kim's team of propagandists might be a little bit smarter. And there will be a next time. This particular failure to launch doesn't mean that North Korea has given up trying. Kim Jong-un may have given up on making his ears look smaller, but he's unlikely to shake his obsession with the Hwasong-17. Lewis says eventually, he's going to get that missile to succeed.
And one of the things I'm concerned about is we're not really emotionally ready to have that conversation.
For the World, I'm Dina Temple-Raston.
Dina Temple-Raston is the host of Click Here, covering the world of cyber and intelligence. Our thanks to Will Jarvis and Sean Powers for their work on the story. As a general rule, Iraqi men take a great deal of pride in their facial hair. Now, that may sound like a sweeping generalization, but let me remind you of the deck of cards the U.S. military used to identify Saddam Hussein loyalists. But after his downfall in 2003, the stash went out of fashion.
During periods of extreme violence, Iraqi men will often change their hair or their facial hair for safety reasons because they can indicate your job, your religiosity, and your sect.
Elise Burr, who writes about foreign affairs for our partners at The Economist, is an observer of the mustache.
For example, a neat mustache can be a sign that you work for the army or intelligence services. And a big, bushy, droopy mustache is a trademark that you are a member of the Kaka'is, which is a minority sect that has been deemed heretical by the Islamic State. So their mustaches really made them a target for Islamic State assassinations.
Burr argues that in Iraq, which is going through a period of relative stability, the recent storming of parliament aside, the mustache is making a comeback.
I spoke with one officer in the army, and he told me he reckons that 80% of his fellow officers have a mustache just like him. And he told me that if the security situation deteriorated and officers started getting targeted, that he would shave off his mustache.
And don't forget the beard, facial hair that really makes a statement in Iraq.
Beards can symbolize a lot. When Islamic State ruled a chunk of Iraq from 2014 to 2017, they forced all the men under their control to grow beards. Beards can also play into other fault lines. For example, there's a group of mostly Shia militias in Iraq known as Hashid al-Shaabi, and they played a big role in vanquishing Islamic State. And the government has since tried to integrate them into the army and bring them under government control. But one sign that that has failed has been because Hashid al-Shaabi members often grow beards, where if you are a full-fledged member of the Iraqi army, you're not allowed to grow a beard.
And Elise Burr says one more sign that Iraq is relatively stable for many men how they wear their hair is now their choice.
A lot of young men are less keen to emulate the facial hair of their fathers and grandfathers. Outlandish, stiffly gelled hairdos are becoming quite popular. But I think this is a really good sign. If you're ditching the mustache for reasons of style rather than safety, that shows that Iraq is becoming a little bit more normal.
That was Elise Burr, who writes about foreign affairs for our partners at The Economist. She was speaking to the Intelligence Podcast about the mustaches worn by Iraqi men. Just a few years ago, the World Bank named Sri Lanka as a development success story. Poverty was down, economic growth was up. Economist Anushka Vijayasinghe with the think tank The Center for a Smart Future describes the situation back in 2015.
Sri Lanka by that point had benefited from decades of good investment in social infrastructure, health, education, tourism was taking off. So there was a lot of reason to be optimistic.
The current economic crisis has derailed that optimism. Basic necessities like fuel and medicine are scarce. Inflation is soaring. Those are the economic headlines. Behind the cold statistics, though, are people. The World's Carolyn Beeler brings us this profile of two families on different ends of the economic spectrum, both being forced to make big changes.
Mohammed Safri and his family live in a suburb of Colombo on a street lined with small single-family homes.
This is chili.
Chili?
There's a garden out front of their two-bedroom house where Safri's mother, Faiza Safri, grows vegetables.
Leeks.
Mint.
His three-year-old daughter, Sara, likes practicing her letters with the alphabet posters hanging in the hallway and watching cartoons on her grandmother's phone. Until this year, the family could buy whatever groceries they wanted and still have enough left over at the end of the week to go out to dinner or do something fun. But since Sri Lanka's economic crisis started several months ago, Mohammed Safri tells me it's become a struggle just to put enough food on the table.
Before, I'm not worried about the food. Now I'm worried, very worried.
Safri is the sole breadwinner for his household, and his employment history follows the trajectory of Sri Lanka's economic crisis. He used to be a chauffeur until the pandemic hit and tourists disappeared. He sold his car and started delivering food on a motorbike. Now he can't get gas for that motorbike, so he's downgraded again to a bicycle.
If I ride in the bike, I'm thinking tonight what we eat, what I get, how much I can earn.
His income has gone way down, and inflation has sent prices shooting up. He pulls a basket of produce out of the fridge to show me.
Lemon here, before 100 grams is 10 or 15 rupees.
Now it's 10 times that. The family has mostly stopped eating meat and cut down on vegetables, too. Safri can only afford to buy his parents' medication a few days at a time. And because there's a cooking gas shortage nationwide, his wife, Fatima Rukia, had to start cooking over a wood fire in the backyard. When she was hospitalized for smoke inhalation, grandmother Faiza Safri took over. I speak with Faiza through an interpreter.
She was little. She saw her mother cooking on a wood fire, so she never in her wildest dreams thought that this would happen, that the country would go backward like this.
Sri Lanka's economic growth after the country's civil war ended in 2009 was fueled by public spending on infrastructure projects. But then the pandemic hit. That, combined with ill-timed tax cuts and risky fiscal policy, all meant the country couldn't pay its debts anymore and defaulted in May. Now there's not enough money for importing basic necessities, and inflation is skyrocketing. The crisis is impacting even those with more of an economic cushion. At a historic seaside Colombo hotel, I meet Alexander and Pumi Mark. They were treating themselves to a drink after a meeting nearby. They both work in marketing. They used to do this kind of thing every weekend. Alexander says they're foodies.
We used to go to all the restaurants in Colombo here, and then we enjoy food. But now we don't do that.
Now they eat at home with their six-year-old daughter, Kendra. And they, too, are eating less to cut down on their ever-growing grocery bill.
Not a lot for her. For us, we have cut down a lot. But for her, we try to give her as much as we can.
Their car has been sitting unused in the garage for months because of gasoline shortages. When Pyumi got a bad case of food poisoning a few months ago, they couldn't get to the hospital.
We didn't have fuel to come in our own car, so we were struggling for like a good 3 hours to find a cab. So finally managed to find one and get to the hospital.
While you have bad food poisoning.
Yeah.
Pyumi laughed it off, but Alexander says not being able to get to the hospital in an emergency, that's scary.
There's nothing you can do, you know. It's a very bad feeling. You have the money, you have resources, but you can't use it.
With inflation continuing to rise, they're worried about being able to continue paying their daughter Kendra's school fees at her international school. They can't take vacations anymore, and they've even delayed plans to have another child. Diapers, Alexander says, cost something like 40,000 rupees.
So that is an average person's monthly salary. So the current situation is horrible. Even we are feeling it, so we always feel, what about the others who can't even afford what we can afford?
Both families I spoke to are most concerned about their daughters. Back at the home of Muhammad Safri and his wife, Fatima Rukeya, I talked to Fatima on the living room couch.
They were young. They enjoyed life. But now it's very difficult to see how the children can enjoy anything.
As I was leaving their home, the power went out. It does that twice a day. And 3-year-old Sara knew exactly what was happening.
Power cut.
The road out of this crisis lies through a bailout package from the International Monetary Fund, which may take several months to negotiate. But that will require Sri Lanka's government to enact fiscal measures that will end up squeezing families like these even more. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler, Colombo.
We leave you today along the border of Mali and Niger in West Africa as the last remaining French soldiers in Mali depart, ending 9 years of fighting against militant jihadists. This song by Mali's best-known and beloved chanteuse, Oumou Sangare, could be translated as War is Not Good or War Must Stop. Kele Magni is the title. Kele Magni is an anti-war phrase that's emerged in any number of compositions, new and traditional, from Mali. In Oumou Sangare's song, she expresses her frustration with the fighting that continues to disrupt the lives of Malians. War has never built anything, she sings. It destroys all it finds. Music there from Mali's Oumou Sangare from her latest album, Timbuktu. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego, online at theworld.org when we are not in your ears. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
From PRX.